of
this
reading through the outline,
won't...
because I won't be able to get through much of it, but I'll do my best to give you the gist of it. But and again, the other two announcements were the webinars tonight, which are constantly involved, 8:30 and 9, yeah, the economic stimulus and then the Osaline one. But the book that I read, The One Small Step Can Change Your Life, The Kaizen Way, is written by Dr. Robert Maurer, who's a PhD. It was just a terrific book, and some of you will see some similarities when you think about the book, The Slight Edge, but this takes it to a whole other level. But it is an application of the principle behind Slight Edge. And so what this book is about how we can really totally affect changes in our life by just taking small steps, and the reason why large steps don't work. And one of the first examples he gives in the book is just a concept around somebody trying to lose weight, and how appropriate is that, especially with our Osaline powder programs and the first of the year just recently happening, how people, you know, they adopt incredible exercise programs. They're going to say, I'm going to go to the gym every day for 30 minutes, and I'm going to really turn a new leaf. Well, and it never works. I mean, shouldn't say never. What is the percentage? Like less than 1% of the people really succeed at that program. And so by succeed mean that they're still engaged in exercise activity 6 months later, because 80% of them quit in the first 2.5-3 months. 80% are gone. They can't even last 3 months of exercise, you know, and very few 6 months later at all. So it's not just about, you know, starting the exercise program in January. People aren't adopting New Year's resolutions about what they do in January. They're talking about changing their lives, but they can't do it. Well, one of the main reasons is Dr. Maurer puts it, and he takes on a concept because he's a psychologist, a neuropsychologist. He understands the brain, function of the brain, and how our body neurologically works. And that's what was so fascinating to me, to really understand the neurology behind this, the biochemistry behind it, so how it makes sense. And what he talked about is a woman who started off and she freaked out about her exercise program, and of course she quit. She's never been able to lose weight. And so when she went to Dr. Maurer, he said, you know what I want you to do? I just want you to march in front of the TV for a minute a day. Well, what happened is she came back exhilarated. Why? Because she couldn't fail on that. I mean, that was something that anyone can do. I mean, march 1 minute in front of a television. And the success that she bred and overcame the fear of I can't eventually led her to start marching 5 minutes a day and then 20 minutes a day, and all of a sudden she got exercise equipment, and this woman became a whole new woman. And it's all about this Kaizen approach. Kaizen is the concept of making small changes in your life over a long period of time will affect tremendous differences, but applying that same approach to the neural connections in our brain and how our brain works. So why does Kaizen work? Why small changes work? Because for virtually every one of us, human nature, changes, even positive ones, are scary. And attempts to meet goals through radical or revolutionary means often fail because what happens is it triggers fear. Fear comes into it, fear that I'm going to fail, fear I can't do it, fear I'm not worthy, fear about everything under the sun. We just love to, you know, that fear is the immediate response, mostly to changes. And when we do dramatic or radical changes, the fear is immediate. And what happens is that if you take small steps, you kind of disarm the brain's fear response. So we understand change is always going to be part of our lives. And that means fear will most inevitably be part of our lives if we choose to lead empowered and enlightened lives and move forward to get, you know, to achieve the greatness that we have in our lives. We're going to be pushing ourselves and we're going to come up against fear. But what we need to do is know how to tackle that fear. And in a way, as he presents in this book, a way that works for everybody, because it in effect disarms our brain from our typical response that we have to fear. So in the book, he talks about how does our brain work. Let's first look at the three brains, or the three parts of the brain, however you want to dictate it. He actually called three brains. He said we have a stem, we have a midbrain or amygdala, and then we have the cortex. And he said the stem is really the part of our brain where autonomic functions take place. That really happens no matter what we do. Of course, sometimes we get electric things out of whack, so our heartbeat gets. But I mean, it's the automatic functions. It sends you to sleep. It wakes you up. It causes the heart to beat. It causes the breathing. These are your autonomic functions. They're controlled by the stem and the brain, and that's part of our brain system. The midbrain, or he also refers to as the amygdala, is what regulates our temperature, stores our emotions, and governs our fight or flight mechanism. Ooh, there's the one. There's that fight or flight. The fear mechanism, emotion is fear is an emotion. That's your midbrain. And then you get to your cortex, which is your area of the brain that's about art and science and creativity and logic and rational thoughts, and all that stuff come out of those creative impulses. So those are the three categories of our brain. So what happens when we take on things, like if we take on an exercise program and fear strikes, we have this overwhelming fear that hits us, that comes from our emotional end of the brain, which is our midbrain or amygdala, okay? And the minute fear hits in our midbrain, in many instances what happens is our biological function, it shuts down access to our cortex. Thus, what happens, like let's say you know of people that were perfect at home and then they go to school and they get in front of and they start trying to take a test and everything's gone. Because fear took in the word test, triggered the word fear. The amygdala is the one that responded to the fear, froze out access to our third area of the brain, which is the cortex. So we lost all of our creative, our rational, all of that side of our brain shuts down because fear caused it to shut down. So amazing, just like people trying to conquer weight loss things. They immediately have a fear, I can't do this, I'm going to fail, and boom, you lose the whole rational, creative side. So you have nothing to help move you forward and create the greatness that you can create in your life because you're shutting it down because that fear is contracting, as I look at it, contracting the amygdala to like choke off access to the cortex. Now, if you know anything about our utilization of our brain in the first place, you know that the average person only uses about 5% of the whole capacity of your brain. That's what statistics tell us. So look what fear just did. Fear just got off. So I'm like going, man, if I only use 5, you know, I work so hard every day of my life to tap into every area of my brain because I just want to enhance that stupid statistic that tells me I only use 5% because it seems like such a waste. Anyway, and now with fear, if you let fear into your life, you're cutting out that whole major part of your brain called the cortex because fear just shuts you down. So the idea behind what, you know, Dr. Maurer talks about throughout this book is the idea that large goals or large, you know, making large commitments, like you tell me I'm going to be presidential by the end of the year, that immediately triggers a fear inside you. Am I going to fail? Da, 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 da. And then all of a sudden it stops the creative, the rational thinking, and guess what happens? You create failure in your life. Whereas if you do bite-sized things, this is his concept, little small steps, little small goals. So maybe your goal this week is to talk to 3 new people or 5 new people. Take little itty-bitty steps. Set small little bite-sized goals. Because each and every one of you know you, if you set a goal to talk to 3 new people this week, you could all accomplish that, every one of you, easily. You could do it 1 hour after you got off this phone call, if you chose to do it. But if you commit to that kind of goal, and then you accomplish that goal, now you overcome fear, you start grappling. The fear is bypassed. So that by having minimal goals set in short periods of time, little bite-sized, small steps, what you're doing is you're not allowing fear to shut down the cortex of your brain. So you're being able to tap into the creative and the rational and the intelligent, the art, the science part of your brain matter, which is such a critical part of your brain to utilize at every opportunity because it allows you to create things you never could think you had the possibility of creating, which for many of us might be getting to presidential, right? And so, but we've been shutting it down, and we need to now take an approach at how do I bypass it. Some people get around this by converting their response to change into excitement. And those are people like Mary Jo, and there would be people like, you know, there are a lot of people out there that thrive on change. And I'm not saying a lot in terms of comparison of those that don't, because the number one thing that people fear in this world is change. I mean, that to the word change, if you know, more people fear change than anything else, and it probably is reflected in upwards of 80% of our population. So the majority of people aren't like the people like me that get excited about change and thrive on it and always look forward to it and love to conquer it, because we just, you know, that's a different human nature that we have. And we thrive on challenges and conflict and all those kind of things, but that's not a norm. That is by far. But just to let you know that there are people out there that can tackle this in a different way, but the majority of us need to look at this concept of overcoming this fear so that we don't shut down those parts of our brain. So the whole concept here is your brain is programmed to resist change, but by taking small steps, you effectively rewire your nervous system. So it unsticks you from the creative block. It bypasses the fight or flight response, which is what causes you so many times to, you know, give up on Manitech or give up on being successful or give up on your dreams. Those are fight or flight responses. Those are fear. Those are emotion. They're coming from the amygdala, and they're shutting down the cortex. They're just giving up on it because you don't want to tackle the fear. The fear just causes you to come to a new belief that you're not going to do it because you can't be creative or logical about it. But the concept of small little steps, those small steps, that creates the new connection between the neurons that allow the brain enthusiastically to take over the process of change. So now your cortex is involved, which is the creative, the thought, the rational, the music, the science, and all of that area of the brain now gets to bring the enthusiasm to the realm of creating the change because you've bypassed the fear. And there's a whole new attitude that you develop around making those additional steps because you've now tapped into the cortex. He also talked about fear, the way we address fear. A lot of people treat fear as if it's almost a disease condition. They talk about fear and they go, oh my gosh, I get stressed out and anxiety and all this stuff. And you know, when fear is nothing more than just fear, that's all it is. Successful people talk about fear as just being fear. It's not stress or anxiety or anything else. You can label all you want a label on it, but it's kind of like it's just a fear. It's just apprehension. It's a concept of that, you know, that maybe this won't work, or maybe, you know, it's just a fear. But we overcome fear. We feel the fear and do it anyway. It's kind of like the Susan Jeffers thing, instead of developing it into a disease condition. So don't take it to another level. Acknowledge it for exactly what it is. And then other people try to mask fear. And they try, you know, they feel that they, hey, I you know, if I live my life correctly, I shouldn't even have to experience fear. And I disagree with that because I think if you live your life correctly, you're constantly pushing yourself to create greater things. And anytime you're pushing yourself out of your comfort zone, you're probably going to experience fear. So fear should be a part of everybody's life at some point in time. And, you know, I talk about being fearless, and sometimes people look at me like that, and I go, that's not necessarily true. I do have fears in my life, but it's like, they don't stop me. They're there, but I don't acknowledge them anything more than that. That's just because I'm trying to accomplish something. There's a little bit of hesitation around it, and I just plow right through it. So I liked his analogy in his book, and I wrote that out there about being a drunk. That he says there, you know, there's a drunk who is looking for his keys on the street under a streetlight, and the policeman came along and asked the drunk, "Well, what are you looking for?" And the drunk says, "My keys." And the policeman then said, "So where did you lose them?" To which the drunk responds, "Down at the end of the block." And shocked, of course, the policeman says, "So why are you looking for them here?" To which the drunk says, "Because there's more light here." And that's somehow analogy to how we treat fear in our life, right? We don't hit it head on. We go down the block to try to interact because we go on a diversion path instead of tackling it right head on. It's really kind of humorous, but that's a great analogy because sometimes we can laugh at ourselves on how we try to tackle fear. So we really need to look at fear straight in the face and not you know, take diversive paths with it. And Lance Armstrong said, "Fear is a priceless education," and I agree with that totally. And the concept of conflict is always a condition of our human life. That's absolutely true. We're always going to come up against conflict, and then we're always going to see fear. Now, he went through the book and he gave us 6 different strategies around tackling this area, and it's all about Kaizen. It's just taking the Kaizen way, which is what one small step can totally change your life. So he says asking small questions to dispel fear and inspire creativity, is one, I'm just going to go through them quickly. So your first strategy is asking small questions. So don't ask yourself how to get to presidential in 2009. Instead, ask, how can I increase my GPV by 500 or 300 or whatever you want to choose? Small question. How can I this month increase my GPV by 300? And then tackle that question. So take bite-sized pieces of it and just really work on bite-size so that you avoid that you know, neurological, stranglehold that the amygdala puts on your cortex. You don't want to freeze out your creative and your scientific and your rational side. You just want to take one little bite at a time and accomplish those little bites one at a time. They also will build for you a great level of confidence. So empower yourself with small questions. So he gives another, and the brain loves questions. The brain absolutely loves to respond to questions. So ask lots of questions, small little questions of yourself. So let's say if health were your challenge, that you want to conquer health, what kind of questions could you ask? You could say, if health were my number one priority, what would I be doing differently? You could ask that question of yourself and then start making a list. And some people, like, let's talk about fat loss. So if fat loss was important to me, what can I do differently? And you go, well, I can stop eating potato chips. Well, see, right now you've done something that's drama. Too big to tackle getting up potato chips. Now, some of you say, well, Mary Jo, but they should, everybody. I mean, that's why I tell all my people, I said, quit drinking diet soda, give up potato chips. Well, but right now you're trying to have a major change in people's life. So what do we talk about here about fear? Fear of failure, and then you cut out the rational and creative side, and now the poor person can't figure out what to replace it with, how to replace a bad habit with a good habit, because their cortex isn't being involved in the whole translation. So they're shutting themselves down, and they're going to fail. You're going to create failure for them. So maybe what you do is when you talk to somebody who loves potato chips and you're trying to help them lose weight, you tell them to do this. You know, every time you open up a bag of potato chips, and you want to, like a package that you're going to eat, take out the first two handfuls and throw them away. And just start with something like that. Now, that's easier for them to do than not eat any. But maybe you just give them smaller steps that are more meaningful to them. Because eventually, then 2 weeks from now, they go, okay, now I'll take out the first three handfuls and throw them away. And pretty soon there's nothing left in the bag. So they get to the point where, why am I throwing away half of what I'm buying? That doesn't make any sense. But it's working with small little steps instead of major steps that make people just freeze and lock down. Because people don't like denial diets anyway. So here's a mechanism that if it gets you the same result that 6 months from now they're not drinking Diet Cokes and they're not eating potato chips, then that's better because they've accomplished it and now they reinforce their accomplishment. So again, small steps. Do small little steps. Small little questions. So I always ask small little questions. Little questions, little questions. Bite-size it all the time. And never use negative questions. I mean, it's all about, he gave some examples of negative questions. They're practicing small questions is at the bottom. You can look at that in the outline. I got to get through the rest of them quickly, so let me move on. The second thing is think small thoughts. And he's really huge on mind sculpture. He talks about using mind sculpture is small thoughts you develop new social, mental, and even physical skills just by imagining yourself performing them. And that's really what this whole concept is. It's about imagining you performing them. So how would this look like in Manitech? Let's say somebody wanted you to do a presentation, and you go, oh, my gosh, and you go into total fear. So what happens to your cortex? You lose all your rational, creative, your science, your art, your music, all that part of your brain just shuts down. So you're not going to be very good because you might not even remember what you're going to say. You're going to shake. You're going to be all sorts of stuff. So how do we use small thoughts to benefit us in this regard with mind sculpture? We picture ourselves. We isolate the task, so whatever that is, giving a presentation, and we determine, on a daily basis, how many seconds am I going to commit to work on this? So because he wants small time periods. So he doesn't want you to commit to an hour a day. He wants to commit let's say you're going to do 20 seconds or half a minute you're going to spend on. So a half a minute, a number of times during the day, multiple times, but a half a minute, what you're going to do is you're going to picture yourself actually doing the task. But you want to be in a very quiet, comfortable spot with closed eyes. Imagine you're in the situation and visualize who else is there in the surrounding, and then he gets you to start utilizing your other senses, smells, sounds, textures, flavors, everything, as if you're performing the task. And then you imagine hearing a positive response. Wow, we love that talk. And you do that. It takes 20 seconds maybe for you to do that whole, maybe even 10 seconds, for you to do that whole experience about sitting in a quiet place, imagine yourself making a presentation in front of a group of people, and then what does it smell like? What does it taste like? What does it feel like? Who's in the audience? Who do I get to see? What faces do I see out there? And then imagine people clapping or really leaning forward to listen to every word that comes out of your mouth. And you just think that through and visualize that. And you do that 4 or 5 times a day for a period of a couple of weeks, and then go do your presentation and watch what happens. You can use mind sculpturing small thoughts to help you develop even physical skills. He talked about athletes that got injured while they were preparing for the Olympics, and they used mind sculpture where they just went through, they visualized, they had quiet time where they just visualized themselves and went through each of the steps of what it was like to be in the starting blocks and put pressure of their feet against those starting blocks and hearing the gun go off and smelling the turf and just racing as fast as they could across that line. And when they got done with their injury, they got out in the blocks and they were just as good, if not better, than they were when they didn't have before they had the injury. And people said, how could they possibly? And it was incredible how the visualization, this mind visualization, helped improve their posturing. Because clearly their muscle tissue and rebuilding hadn't been quite where it was before, but their mind had helped them with their physical skills, their abilities. So we can use that in Manatech as well. We can do that to overcome adversity. And I know I use that kind of thought process a lot. Like when I meet somebody new, I do it just automatic. When I meet somebody new and I really enjoy their company, I already have a visualization of where I'm putting them in my downline and build, and helping them grow and watching their business grow. I already have that visualization. And some of you do it too, but some of you do it with a negative visualization. You go into, no, notice how I get phone calls and they go, oh, Mary Jo, but I don't think she, and you guys go negative. It's like you have a fear that they're not going to sign up. And I'm like, where is that coming from? I just go freak out. It's like, come on, you guys. You never have a thought they're not going to join you. You're going to create your own reality. See how fear enters in? And then when you get fearful about them not joining you and you already take a negative tact, do you think you're going to tap into your cortex, into your creative brain, into that science, the art, the music, the logical, the rational side of that brain to be able to be effective in drawing them into your Manatech business when fear is already struck? Wow. See how you shut down your abilities. The next step is take small actions. In other words, you know, take little bitty actions. You know, if you want to find a new business, turn yourself and I have to find a new business builder this week. No, you can start off with saying, okay, I need to find a new business builder. Take small actions. Today I'm going to make a list of 10 possible people. And you start with that. Just little actions. Tomorrow I'm going to approach one of those people. Little actions. Take small little steps. You know, if you want to develop a list of prospects, how do I do that? Well, you can just start off by today I'm going to come up with a new idea. See, if you just say, oh my gosh, I got to come up with 500 names, that can put so much fear in you that if you put fear and that amygdala stops, is the chokehold on the cortex. Where are all the names that you want to come up with? They're all in your cortex. They're on your creative side, in your rational side, in your, you know, tapping into all the creative juices flowing about how to find prospects and what to do and build a prospecting list. And your fear of having to have to come up with 500 names just shuts you down. So don't work at it that way. Just start off with, today I want to come up with one new idea of where to find new people. One new idea. That's all. One new idea. And look at the relaxation you go through and just like, wow, that's very peaceful and restful to think I only need to come up with one idea. So come up with, again, small steps, itty-bitty steps, little bite-sized steps so that fear doesn't cut you off. Be patient with it, too, because people aren't patient are going to, you know, they're going to give up on the process. And a lot of us have a hard time overcoming our cultural training of, you know, instantaneous, you know, gratification. and that doesn't happen in network marketing. I think all of you can agree to that. Number four was solve small problems. I thought this was awesome, and I'm just going to highlight, you know, there's many areas of problems in our life. Relationships are huge. You can have a small problem with somebody, and I bet if I talk to each one of you on the call today individually, you could tell me a small problem you have with somebody in your downline. But what you do is instead of going face-to-face and confronting it, because you hate conflict, and I'm just telling you it's not conflict, but you view it as conflict. Give conflict a different, you know, give it a different meaning. But if you don't address the small problem that you have with somebody in your life, what happens to it? It destroys you, it destroys them, it destroys the relationship, it eats away, it robs you of energy, it robs you of joy. It stays a conflict, and it's something that's ever present in your life. It's like what I call unfinished business. I don't like unfinished business because it steals from me, and I don't want anyone robbing from my joy and my ability to have the freedom of every day to enjoy the abundance that God's got in store for me every day. So it's like, I don't want to carry the baggage. So if I have something that's a problem, there's a clogging, I just want to go and let's get it resolved. And that doesn't always mean that it's not about what the result is. It's not about the other person, you know, saying they're sorry or that. It's just about resolving it, so it's not lingering. Resolve it. Put the energy forth to do what you can do to resolve it. You're not always in control. The other person takes action too, but you, at least you've hit it head on. You didn't bury it. You didn't cover it up. Because when you cover it up, it just gets worse. And the biggest analogy he wrote in this book was the story about the Columbia. And some of you are familiar with that space, the Columbia ship. And what happened when the Columbia took off, foam broke off of the Columbia, off the fuselage, and it hit the wing's leading edge on the spaceship, which caused it not to be able to reenter, and of course, seven astronauts died. Well, when they did the research behind it, what was transpired and what really happened, they found out that in three or four prior flights, spaceship flights, they already had seen that this foam would kick off from time to time. But they never tackled the little problem. They never went and said, okay, what can we do different? They never made the investment of time and energy to tackle the small problem until it created seven deaths. Look what we could have prevented if we would have tackled the small problem. So his concept of tackling small problems is so huge for us as people and individuals instead of letting them linger. Because everything that, you know, unfinished business, lingering stuff, when you just bypass or overlook or ignore small problems, and if you do it in your marriage, people, you're a dead duck. You're divorced. I mean, you don't overlook small problems. Because you're either green or growing or ripe and rotting. You don't want a marriage to be rotting. You don't want any relationship to be rotting. So don't overlook small problems. Tackle them and move on. And then bestow small rewards just as a concept of, you know, they could be as recognition, you know, all sorts of things that we do. And he did a great, you know, study of what happens in Japan versus the United States. You know, the United States, we have different ways of acknowledging people and recognizing people. And it just, the Japanese were so much more effective because in the United States, we always made rewards, you know, employees to make changes and offer changes for the company. They would get $10,000 reward or something like that. And then what they were doing is they were making all the employees do it just purely out of motivation of greed and money. And in the Japanese culture, they did it out of motivation, intrinsic motivation, to make the workplace a better place to work for everyone. So they had this community interest thing going on, so incredible. So people, it wasn't even about money. It could be the average reward in the U.S. factory was 10 times what it was in the Japanese factory. But the rewards they gave out in the Japanese factories were like, you know, presidential recognition, a pen, engraved pen, you know, from the president of the company, or an acknowledgement of that you were the one that instituted this new change in the factory. And 95% of the suggestions became part of what they did different in the factories because people were looking for small little changes that could make a difference. In the U.S. factories, we put a $10,000 bill on it, so everybody was trying to make major changes to justify the $10,000, and their whole system became useless and worthless because we had approached it from a level of greed or all money as the only motivation. We missed the intrinsic motivation that's so critical. And then the last thing, the sixth point that he said is recognize the small but crucial moments. And these are, this is also an incredible thing. You can look at different things in our life that happen where we have special moments that occur. Do we really recognize them? Are we taking advantage of those special moments, you know, that occur in different things, and making a shift around that special moment, recognizing the small moments, the small things, so that we can do corrective action or take specific action and build off of that. And I love the Harriet Beecher Stowe quote. He said, to be really great in little things, to be really heroic and noble in the inspired details of everyday life is a virtue so rare as to be worthy of canonization. I thought that was so incredible. That was one of my favorites. And the last thing I'll talk about is just a study that they did. Dr. John Gottman, a psychologist, did a study with many couples just grading their behavior over a time period. He put them all in this kind of like condominium complexes, and they studied couples interacting with each other. And after this lengthy period of studying numerous couples, Dr. Gottman predicted what their marriage would be like in 3 to 5 years. And he was 93% right on the couples that were getting divorced. And it had nothing to do with their getaway vacations they planned and all the romantic dinner, you know, the stuff where they went out to wild and crazy dinners and all this stuff. It had everything to do with just the little things and the way the two people interacted. When one talks to the other, does the other put the newspaper down and respond and really listen? Is there joy and really truthfulness in listening to the other partner? Is there, you know, simple signs of respect that coexist between the two parties and really make it work? It was a fascinating, it was all about what? The little crucial moments where the interchange took place and how much respect the two people gave each other in those crucial time periods. Because when you're married, you know, you don't spend a lot of time necessarily around your spouse. So how are you spending those crucial moments? And that's just cool. And last night I was having so much, my husband came home from a bridge tournament. And he gets home, and all he wants to do is talk about bridge hands and all that stuff. And you know what? I would typically sit there with my computer and just kind of listen out of one ear. And after I did this summary on this book, I was like, oh, Mary Jo, come on. So I just put everything down, and I just was be with. I just gave him my full attention. And I'm telling you, the responsiveness throughout the rest of the evening of him was a totally different. I mean, it was a very different relationship. Not that we don't have a good relationship, but I mean, it was all of a sudden, it was something really special. And how many of us just, I mean, so these little things that you just pick up from these books that are so great about just things that we can do, if we could only have the reminders every day of our life, because it's hard to be that person all the time. But people, the reality is that we just need to look at the small things that we could do that make gigantic differences. And that's what this book is about. And I encourage you to get it and read it. I think you'll enjoy every bit of it, as I did. And I think it's just fascinating to understand, you know, why fear works the way it does in our brain. I just love that whole, you know, biochemistry, biological aspect of it, so that we can talk about, you know, why we freeze up, why people don't get things done, why they get, I can't do it. They get caught up in the fear and the change, and change bothers them and all these things, and what it's actually doing in our human body, so that we understand how we can overcome it in a better way. All right, everybody. Love you all. I hope you enjoyed the call today. Sorry we went so long, but I know there's a lot of things out there. And just have a great, great week, second week of the business period. So let's go out and do a lot of great things. And then I can't wait to see you guys next week at Manifest. So I just hope and pray that a lot of you come. Love you all.